Hello there. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump makes a controversial statement that has Jewish American organizations in an uproar.
I can't imagine if she has any Jewish people in her district that they could possibly vote for.
Democrats say Trump is playing the same about-face game when it comes to gun reform. Also ahead, the latest food trend that enthusiasts say could be the answer to climate change. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump has stirred a new controversy in a statement that mixes religion and politics.
I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
Trump's claims to reporters at the White House Tuesday triggered an uproar from Jewish American organizations who said the president was trading in anti-Semitic stereotypes. It came amid his ongoing feud with Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, both of whom are Muslim. Trump has closely aligned himself with Israel, including its conservative Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, while the Muslim lawmakers have been outspoken critics of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. Tlaib is a U.S.-born Palestinian-American, while Omar was born in Somalia. At Trump's urging, Israel last week blocked Omar and Tlaib from entering the country.
Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these two people over the state of Israel?
Well, both congresswomen support a global protest of Israel. Joining us now to talk more about all of it is Rabbi Terry Bookman, author of three books on Jewish spirituality. His latest is titled Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thank you for being with us, Rabbi Bookman. So as a Jew and a religious leader, what's your reaction to the president's comments regarding Jews voting for Democrats would be disloyal?
It's never a good idea for someone to make blanket statements about another ethnic, religious, racial group without being a part of that group. It's one thing for one to say from within one's group to one's other fellows and sisters within the group, but to say it from the outside is never really a good idea, and it's always pretty dangerous to do so. So from the get-go, that was bad form, bad taste, bad idea. But when you cut under that, go beyond that, the big question is, to whom are we American Jews being disloyal?
He didn't really clarify that, whether are Jews being disloyal to him? Are they being disloyal to the country? Are they being disloyal to their religion? What do you expect he meant?
I think he meant that we're being disloyal to our faith and to Israel, because he's trying to, you know, create a wedge within the Jewish community. But the only ones we're being disloyal to is Donald Trump. And we know that loyalty for him is sine qua non. He values loyalty to him, blind loyalty to him, as the number one thing. So, yes, we're not loyal to him, nor should we be. We are American Jews, who, most of whom grew up as Democrats and remain loyal to the Democratic Party because it expresses values that are important Jewish values. And as an American Jew, I have lots of loyalties. I'm loyal and lots of interests, lots of concerns. I consider myself very loyal to this country and to Israel. But loyalty doesn't mean blind loyalty or never saying something that might be critical of the person with whom you're loyal. Loyalty is not about keeping your mouth shut. In fact, that's probably opposite. If you see someone you care about doing the wrong thing or going astray, loyalty is to say something, not to keep your mouth shut.
Well, this whole thing, President Trump's comments saying this about loyalty, Jewish people being loyal if they vote, not loyal if they vote for Democrats, it stemmed from him talking about, again, the two congresswomen who he encouraged Israel to ban from coming in, and standing by that, again, repeating that he said that they hate Israel and they hate Jewish people. If you disagree with the policies of a nation like Israel, to even the degree that these women do, they're also Muslim, and they care about the plight of the Palestinians. So does that make them hate Israel, hate Jews, and possibly hate this country?
Not at all. One can be critical of one's country and still love one's country. Many veterans protested the war in Vietnam when I was growing up. They were very loyal. Some of them lost friends, lost limbs. So they're clearly loyal Americans, but they saw something in their country that they disagreed with. So loyalty does not mean I'm never critical. In fact, I think it's the opposite. When I'm loyal to someone, I really want them, I want the best for them, and I want them to do their best. And if I see them doing something that's not, I'm going to speak up. Criticism does not equal loyalty. It might in Donald Trump's worldview if you criticize him, therefore you are against him, but I just don't buy into that whole narrative or that paradigm. Now, with the congresswomen, I don't agree with everything they say, but they do have the right to say it. And by the way, they are Americans, first and foremost, representing a district and people within their own community, and they have a right to represent them. And, you know, they may not agree with everything that Israel does. I don't agree with everything that Israel does. That doesn't make me disloyal at all. You know, I think that what Trump is trying to do, the bottom line here, he's trying to paint the squad as the face of the Democratic Party, even though they represent a kind of a young liberal fringe of the party, to draw people and to distract people away from him and to try to draw people away from voting for Democrats. I think that's what politically is going on here. And every chance he gets, he's doing that. And I think it's unfortunate that BB is under his thumb right now.
All right, that's Rabbi Terry Bookman. He is the author of 3 books on Jewish spirituality, his latest titled Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Well, with a series of recent mass shootings and a growing call for stricter gun reform, initially President Trump came out in favor of background checks for gun buyers. But The Atlantic magazine is reporting that Trump has told the head of the National Rifle Association that strengthening background checks for gun buyers is, quote, off the table. Speaking to reporters at the White House, Trump declined to say whether he endorsed any of the gun legislation backed by House Democrats, but he said the administration has been engaged in talks with Democrats. Yet now he appears to be lukewarm on the idea, telling reporters Tuesday he's worried about a slippery slope when all of a sudden everything is taken away.
We have very, very strong background checks right now. But we have sort of missing areas and areas that don't complete the whole circle.
President Trump said Tuesday his administration is in meaningful talks, but aides downplayed the discussions as low level and not productive. Democrats have accused Trump of reversing course after he initially voiced support for tougher background checks. Since then, he has shifted his approach, however, calling the shooters mentally ill and saying the administration had to look at building more mental institutions. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The White House insists the fundamentals of the U.S. economy are very strong. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, unlike President Trump, says he's concerned about North Korean missile tests. Somalia's regional election raises national East African tensions. And check out Meet the Democratic Presidential Candidates, an in-depth look at the men and women vying to unseat President Trump in 2020. Find expanded coverage of all of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. military has just tested a ground-based cruise missile with a range that would have been banned a mere 3 weeks ago. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
The Pentagon says the missile was launched from an island off California's coast and hit its target after more than 500 kilometers of flight. That distance is important. The United States previously could not pursue ground-based missiles with a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. They were locked in the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, a decades-old arms control pact with Russia. VOA previously reported that Washington withdrew from that pact on August 2nd, citing years of Russian violations. The Pentagon stressed that this cruise missile was not configured to carry a nuclear weapon, but rather a conventional payload, the type of conventional ground-based missile that new Secretary of Defense Mark Esper recently said he'd like to put in Asia.
We would like to deploy a capability sooner rather than later because of the importance of the great distances we need to cover and how important an intermediate range conventional weapon would be to the Asia Indo-PACOM theater.
Esper declined to tell us when or where the missiles could be deployed within the region during his trip there this month. Analysts primarily have focused on what the INF treaty withdrawal means for signatory nations Russia and the United States. But they say the end of the INF could be allowing the United States to strengthen its position against China. According to Esper, more than 80% of China's missile inventory has a range of 500 to 5,500 kilometers. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
And you're listening to... Oh, excuse me. We have one more story before we're going to take a break. At least 35 people have been killed and hundreds injured on the Pakistan side of the disputed Kashmir region. International Edition's Steve Miller talks to Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about the ongoing cross-border clashes between Pakistan and India.
These figures that were released by the president of the Pakistani-administered Kashmir are quite, shocking in a way that we know that these clashes have been going on across the disputed Kashmir border for the last 2 weeks. But we also know that Indian side also has come up with some casualty figures of their own. But these figures clearly, indicate that the situation is much more serious than what is being reported by both the sides. And that is why we understand that within a week, President Donald Trump has picked up the phone and spoken to Prime Minister Imran Khan twice and Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, basically urging them to show restraint because there are fears that this situation can really get out of control and could lead to a major conflict between the two countries.
Right. So urging restraint is very much important to try and alleviate the threat of casualties. But what are officials really going to be able to do to alleviate the violence?
Well, that is a good question because both the sides are sticking to their traditional positions on Kashmir, and Pakistan has been consistently demanding that India reverse its actions of August 5th when it stripped its portion of Kashmir of its constitutional autonomy. And that is what Pakistan has been, saying that unless that is reversed and that security lockdown and the communication blackout in Indian Kashmir that has been there now for almost 2 weeks should be lifted before any, dialogue or discussion can take place between the two countries on this issue. So, I mean, as far as bilateralism is concerned, Pakistan says it is not going to have any discussion with India directly unless these steps are taken. And India continues to maintain that whatever it has done in its part of Kashmir is under its own constitution. But obviously, that position is in question after the UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting discussing Indian actions. So that is where an international intervention was required, and maybe that's what prompted President Trump to really tell these two countries to reduce tensions. But so far, we don't see any indication on the ground because the president of the Pakistani Kashmir today told a crowded news conference that these clashes across the line of control which separates Pakistani and Indian Kashmir are still ongoing.
What else do we need to know about what's going on in Kashmir?
There have been violent protests, street protests, but then we have also seen that there has been a serious retaliation from the Indian security forces. What has happened in the meantime that we know that Indian Kashmir has been witnessing this Muslim insurgency and which India alleges that Pakistan is supporting. But right now what has happened is that those pro-India Kashmiri leaders who have long opposed the insurgent groups and who have always respected the Indian constitution have also been detained since August 5th when India scrapped the constitutional autonomy for Kashmir. And those Indian, pro-Indian Kashmiri leaders remain in custody. No one knows what is happening to them. And, you know, Indian media itself has reported that as many as 4,000 people are currently being detained, and they include politicians, activists, and even human rights civil society representatives.
All right, that's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad speaking with my colleague Steve Miller. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, as the UN urges nations to move away from current land use policies and animal agriculture methods, the demand for plant-based food alternatives has continued to grow. But there is now also another growing food trend that's high in protein, apparently, and gaining in popularity. Joining us to talk more about it is Hannah Shanwan, who specializes in consumer products litigation and teaches U.S. food law and policy at Columbia Law School. Thanks for being with us, Hannah. So insects, that's the new food trend.
The technical name for this is called entomophagy, which is humans eating bugs.
Humans eating bugs. Okay, so are you saying that it's a thing now? Eating insects is becoming a trend? Trendy?
It is. In fact, there are some reports that insect farming as a source of alternative protein is going to grow to about all kinds of products that are growing on shelf, especially in health food stores. A lot of times these products are not necessarily where you see antenna and legs and carapaces right in front of you. People in the United States are too uncomfortable with seeing whole insects still. So right now in the U.S. in particular, we're seeing a lot of products where the bugs have been roasted and ground up into something more neutral and as a background ingredient.
Where are they getting these bugs? Are they breeding them like they would animals? You know, we also have sort of an insect concern as far as extinction goes, too.
Believe it or not, there are cricket farms and mealworm farms. They take up a very small footprint compared to a large cattle farm, obviously, because you can raise these creatures in boxes that stack up high, and you can have a warehouse as opposed to a giant use of arable land dedicated to roaming cattle or chickens. But they're being bred. They can be bred with some consistency and turned into these ingredients that people are starting to become much more fascinated by.
So are you saying mealworms and crickets, are those the main insects people are turning to and that they are consuming?
Well, those are two that have gained a lot of traction in the U.S., but there are, of course, others. There are bees and spiders and centipedes and all kinds of other insects, and it's extremely interesting because the people who create these products are very passionate. They really think they're going to save the planet, and they're often ready to point out not only how long humans have been eating insects as a part of human history, but frankly, the average American eats about 2 pounds of dead insects and insect parts a year because they're in our vegetables, our rice, our pasta, our broccoli, our beer.
They are?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, the average chocolate bar, I hate to say this, but the average chocolate bar has about 8 insect parts and less than 60 insect pieces per 100 grams of chocolate is usually deemed safe for consumption by the FDA. It's very difficult to get rid of insects in our food. And so our system is not make sure they're all gone, but what level is safe. And the reality is insects are high value, high density, high quality protein and nutrients. I could give you a long list of all the great minerals and amino acids and vitamins that are in insects.
Give us just a couple.
potassium, magnesium, calcium, sodium, vitamin B12. There are a lot more.
Wow. Are you seeing this as a growing industry?
Absolutely. And it may help to put this in context. You and I and many others enjoy pizza, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't really arrive as a type of food until the 50s. Mexican hit the 70s. Sushi wasn't something that became widespread until the 1990s. And if you think about it, sushi, which is raw fish was considered so disgusting by most people as a type of food
mm-hmm.
before the 1990s. Lobster was a trash fish fed to prisoners. Mm-hmm. For a long time, it was called the cockroach of the sea. Pork belly was not a delicacy. All these things that 20, 30 years ago would have been considered disgusting, repellent, and certainly wouldn't have commanded the high prices at the fancy restaurant. We are facing globally a big crisis, both in our environment and in terms of and population growth and food production, and there are a lot of people who are looking to insect protein as potential solution, and they're very excited about it, very enthusiastic. I've spoken with a number of people in the industry, and they are young, and they are excited to be out helping to save the world, and it's great to see them at it.
Are people eating anything right now but the powdered kind, or is that mainly what they're going for, is the ground up sort of turned into flour type?
Well, those flowers are kind of the gateway bug.
Your gateway bug as opposed to gateway drug.
Right. Who know a lot about this stuff. I am very enthusiastic about all of these benefits personally. But even I, faced with a fork full of cricket pasta, I look at it and I think, I'm about to eat crickets. And my whole body just kind of reflexively flinches mm-hmm. at the idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
My kids, however, love it.
Really?
So in some ways, it's generational. My children love it, although I have to say they don't like the leftover version when it's been cold and reheated. But when they eat it fresh,
leftover
they love
bug.
The cricket pasta. There are people out there who are being more aggressive about trying to familiarize people with the entire insect. So you'll see pasta tossed with mealworms or centipedes.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the insight. I probably will pass on the pasta with centipedes, but thank you so much. That's Hannah Shanwan, who specializes in consumer products litigation and teaches U.S. food law and policy at Columbia Law School.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers from Spain's University of Barcelona and the French Besançon Astronomical Observatory suggests that the Milky Way galaxy experienced a period of intense star-making about 2 to 3 billion years ago. Writing in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics, the scientists reached their findings by analyzing data gathered by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. The researchers say they found that about half of the stars that make up the Milky Way's galactic disk were created during the stellar baby boom. Before the time of this boost in star formation, the scientists suggest that our galaxy was beginning to run low on the gas used to make stars when a satellite galaxy crashed into and merged with the Milky Way. It's thought that the satellite galaxy was rich with this gas, and when it merged with our home galaxy, boosted its star-making capabilities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, Taylor Swift's success seems to know no bounds. Her latest single, Lover, has sold nearly 1 million copies, and it has not even been released yet. The song that is on her highly anticipated new album comes out Friday. The album itself is approaching pre-sale of close to 1 million copies. Swift has released 4 new songs in the lead-up to this latest blockbuster hit.
Have I known you 20 seconds, 20 years? Can I go where you go?
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Lover. We could let our friends crash in the living room. This is our place. We
make the call. And I'm highly suspicious that everyone who sees you wants you. I've loved you 3 summers now, honey, but I want them all. Can I go?
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Religious freedom has come under increasing attack in China. U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom Commissioner Gary Bauer said China has declared war on all religious faiths.
Christians, house churches, or underground churches have come under tremendous assault. The last year or so, there have been churches that have been shuttered, others that have been literally demolished. And then recently they started moving against the churches that did register and did follow the government's guidelines. But it's not just the Christians. There's been a lot of news about what's happening to Chinese Muslims, the Uyghurs, where internment camps have been set up. The estimates are between 1 and 3 million Chinese Muslims are in these camps.
Commissioner Bauer said the bottom line is that China is sending a message to its people that they will not tolerate Chinese citizens having loyalty to anything above the Chinese Communist Party. Speaking at the recently concluded Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said China is home to one of the worst human rights crises of our time.
In September of last year, Chun Weixia, a member of the Falun Gong, was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison simply for practicing his faith. In May of 2018, authorities arrested Wang Yi, the pastor of Early Rain Covenant Church, a large unregistered church in Chengdu, for openly criticizing the government's controls on religious freedom. He's still in jail today.
The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has also called for the release of numerous prisoners of conscience from around the world. One of those is imprisoned Chinese Christian church leader Wu Shijian. Wu is a religious freedom advocate who suffered torture during a previous 16-year prison sentence, was detained again in 2015, and sentenced in 2016 to a 7.5-year sentence for so-called subversion of government power. The United States is vigorously promoting religious freedom as part of its foreign policy. As Secretary Pompeo has said, religious freedom is embedded deeply in the American character, but it isn't exclusively an American idea. Indeed, just the opposite. The UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights affirms religious freedom or belief as a universal right.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
This is VOA News.